Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. See homedepot.com/delivery for details.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Hello, I'm Peter King. Welcome to the MMQB podcast with Peter King, where I take you inside the minds of the biggest influencers in the NFL. This week, a couple of special guests from the media world. In the wake of the devastating Aaron Rodgers collarbone injury, I've got Bob McGinn, who has covered the Packers for nearly 40 decades in Wisconsin. And I've got the longtime radio voice and a great raconteur, Brad Sham of the Dallas Cowboys. But first, a couple of thoughts on a new star in the NFL who I've gotten to know a bit, and just the reason why I think America really likes football in the wake of all of the reasons not to like football. Because of the CTE concerns with parents, which are real, because of all the protests that occurred during the national anthem at games. I mean, there's a lot right now to look at the NFL and say, man, this league's got some serious problems. But there's a player who's come into the NFL this year. One of the reasons I really like covering this game, and one of the reasons I've covered it now, this is my 34th season covering the NFL. One of the reasons it's always so fun is that nothing is forever in the NFL. Now, it seems that way because the Patriots, they're going to be good until we all die. But I think, you know, when I say nothing is forever, I mean that, you know, every year there's three or four or five stories that you say, oh my God, how did that happen? Some team rises, a bunch of teams fall, you know, and it's things that you really don't expect. And this year, probably the most interesting new person in the NFL that I know of, anyway, is Deshaun Watson of the Houston Texans. And I am drawn to him this particular week because I watched a lot of the Texans game against the Cleveland Browns on Sunday. And in that game, Deshaun Watson threw three touchdown passes, and that makes him the first rookie quarterback in NFL history to have three consecutive games in his rookie year where he's thrown at least three touchdown passes. He's actually thrown 4, 5, and 3 in those three games. So he actually leads the NFL in touchdown passes after 6 weeks. It's amazing when you think about it. The third quarterback picked in the draft was knocked by a lot of guys, a lot of draft experts entering the draft because of the huge transition he was going to have to make from college football at Clemson in a vastly different offensive system than he was going to play under Bill O'Brien as sort of your classic pro-style NFL coach. So everybody thought there was going to be a long learning curve. Well, Deshaun Watson came in and he just became a studying bandit. And so, you know, fast forward to now that, you know, of all of the rookie quarterbacks this year, obviously, Deshaun Watson has played better than anybody. Now, the second-year quarterbacks, Jared Goff and Carson Wentz, have both been a revelation this year. But as far as rookie guys, I think it's been so interesting to watch as Deshaun Watson takes his place, most likely, among the better quarterbacks in football. Just a quick story. I'm under the impression now that when I meet guys that there's going to be this huge gap, this this, you know, because I'm 60 years old and they're whatever they are, 22, 23, 24. And, you know, I've only talked to Deshaun Watson a couple of times. But what I find so interesting about him is that he does everything right. When I say that, I mean, you know, he said all the right things when he was drafted. Oh, it doesn't bother me that I fell in the draft. It doesn't bother me that Cleveland, that needed a great quarterback, passed on me, even though they were considering me strongly. It doesn't matter that I'm coming in behind Tom Savage. He's a great quarterback. I've just got to work as hard as I can. And all this stuff, you would think, man, this is, you know, this is a little bit too slick and everything. But, you know, I know people with the Texans, and they would swear that all of the stuff in Deshaun Watson that they see and that you hear about him is absolutely right. He's already given one of his paychecks to three lunch ladies in the Texans cafeteria who suffered severe flood damage on their homes during the recent flooding in the Houston area. He wore Warren Moon's number one Houston jersey to the game on Sunday to work. And I talked to him after the game. He said, I wanted to honor Warren. He's meant a lot to this city. He's meant a lot to the quarterback business. And so, like I say, he does everything right. I just think that as much as we can find fault right now with what's going on in the National Football League in so many ways, I think you look at Deshaun Watson, and that's a guy who I could tell people, I would tell them, buy Deshaun Watson's jersey for your kid. You won't regret it. And as you know, listening to this podcast for the last year or so, you can't say that about everybody in the NFL, but I know you can say it about Deshaun Watson. Hey, look, there's a lot of things I could have talked about today, but after this weekend, you know, I had conversations with a bunch of players, Adrian Peterson, he is one heck of a story right now, and others. But to me, Deshaun Watson is just a shining example of what you see when very good parenting by his mom and very good values instilled in him at an early age really comes home. So I can tell you this, Deshaun Watson is going to be an asset, not only for the Houston Texans, but for the NFL over the next few years. And I'll be very, very surprised if he's not a hugely successful quarterback. And now my conversation with Bob McGinn. I'm so pleased to be joined on the MMQB podcast with Peter King by Bob McGinn, who for 38 years covered the Green Bay Packers for newspapers in Wisconsin. And now, just this past September, began his own website. It's called BobMcGinnFootball.com. He's a co-owner of the website with his industrious son, Charlie. And after a long career working for others, now Bob is finally working for himself. Just to give you an idea about Bob McGinn's experience covering the NFL, he began as a backup beat writer covering the Packers in 1979, and he took over the beat full-time in 1984. One of the reasons why over the years I've had so much admiration for Bob McGinn is that he is a true journalist who covers the covers a team. When I say a true journalist, because, look, we all went to people who work in this business who went to journalism school. We all took journalism classes. We all took ethics. Bob McGinn is the most ethical sports writer I've ever met. Everything has to be absolutely by the book. There's so many sports writers who like to share information. Bob just likes to go do his job by himself and share his information with his readers, not with other writers. And I've had great admiration for him over the years. I want to read you one thing before we get started with Bob. I want to read you one thing that Mark Murphy, who's the president of the Packers, told me in the summer when Bob McGinn retired from the newspaper business in Wisconsin, and he basically went out and hung a shingle out and started to do this on his own with his son. But Mark Murphy so valued Bob, I think, as a guy, kind of a keeper of the flame. Here's what he said. Bob was an icon. I would get letters from fans quoting Bob McGinn. He timed the hang time of punts. He timed the hang time for the snapper to get it back to the punter. So that's a little bit about Bob McGinn, and I've had him on today because I really want to talk about many things, mostly the Packers without Aaron Rodgers, but also about the state of our business and a few other things. But anyway, Bob, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, and I think it'll be an educational few minutes for my listeners.
I hope so, Peter. Thank you very much. We go back when you started with the Bengals and I started with the Packers right in there in about 84 on a full-time basis.
Yep. Yeah, that was really fun. But anyway, so we've gotten to know each other over the years, and we have a little bit of a mutual admiration society, but I can tell you that I would be far more the leader of the pack for the McGinn Admiration Society. But I'm going to... I'll start now, Bob, by we're going to get to Rodgers in a second, but I want to preface it by saying that you had one of the coolest interviews I've read in a long, long time on your website, BobMcGinnFootball.com, on Sunday. You interviewed Bud Grant, the 90-year-old former coach of the Minnesota Vikings. And what I found so interesting about the interview, two things. Number one, no love for Vince Lombardi. He thought Vince Lombardi was a bully. He coached against him, and he really did not like Vince Lombardi. And one of the great stories, I think, that probably you have ever heard in your career is when Bud Grant was the coach of the Winnipeg Blue Bombers of the CFL, and there was a player he wanted, but who was on a bus who was about to exit Canada. And I'd love you to tell me the story, who that was, what happened, why it happened. Tell our listeners about Bud Grant and the time he scurried down to the border between Canada and the United States.
So Bud was named head coach of the Winnipeg Blue Bombers at age 29. Management just told him, Peter, he was a heck of a player up there for 4 years, and he had been a good player with the Eagles before that. But anyway, he got back from the CFL All-Star game at 29 and said, Bud, you're a coach. We like how you, your mind, and we're having this trouble, and you're the coach. So anyway, there's a player by the name of Dale Hackbart who got out of Wisconsin, kind of a quarterback safety. And the Packers drafted him in the fifth round in 1960, and he played for them for about a year and a half, and Lombardi traded him to Washington, I believe. And then that didn't go so good, so then Dale decided to try baseball. He had played for the Badgers, and he was playing for Grand Forks in the Northern League, and one of the franchises in this Class C league was Winnipeg. So Bud had played some baseball in the summer out of Superior, Wisconsin, where he's from. Bud's always up north, Peter. Everywhere he's been, man, it's in the cold. So Dale's playing for Grand Forks in Winnipeg, and Bud goes over to see him. And he's looking for a combination, an American, you know, with the roster limitations, a QB and a defensive back. And he talks to Dale after the game, and Dale's all fired up. He's hitting pretty good, and he's really excited about baseball. So about 3 months later, Bud goes back and sees him again at Winnipeg. And now he's hitting 230, and Bud says he can't hit the curveball. And Bud's convinced the kid can't play. And he's going to now pounce on him for the Blue Bombers. So the game's rained out. Bud had to run home. And then he goes back to the stadium to talk to Hackbart. And Hackbart now has departed on the bus. This thing's a washout. And he's heading the border, to the U.S. border, 70 miles south of Winnipeg. Well, Bud has some friends down there in the Border Patrol. And he calls him, and he says, don't let that bus leave before I get there. So Bud hightails it down there. And they stop him. They stop the bus, and Bud goes over and boards the bus. And he said there's bodies, all these young kids just sleeping all over the place. He rouses Hackbart, And he says, listen, you're coming with me. I know this. You can't hit, and you're going to have a lot of fun. You're going to be on our team. Training camp starts in a week, and you're just going to play football. And Dale says, I am. He said, yes, you are. So he hauls him off the bus and brings him back. Now, so Lombardi gets wind of this, and he still has his rights because he drafted him in the fifth round in 1960, several years earlier. Well, anyway, he wants him. So he calls Bud, and now Bud changes his voice to imitate Lombardi. give me Hackbar's phone number. Bud's telling, well, I'm not giving you his phone number. We want him down here right now. We need a defensive back. And so they went back and forth, and so then Bud went to talk to Dale, and Dale didn't want to talk to him, and then he relayed that message to Lombardi, and Lombardi hung up on him. You know, this is this 33-year-old coach in the CFL who Lombardi doesn't know from Adam, and he just, well, as you said, Peter, he's trying to bully him. And anyway, Hackbart ended up staying in Winnipeg, played, and then later he played for the Vikings when Bud was there for, like, he was a starting safety, I think, or corner for 5 or 6 years. So that's the story. And but Bud changing his voice, you know, send him down here right now.
You know what's great about that?
Busting him out.
What's great about that whole story, honestly, is that a couple of years ago, Bud Grant wrote a book, almost like a memoir, and also a book about basically how he'd fix football and all the things that, you know, no fair catch on punts and everything. And so it was a very interesting book. And I went and interviewed him, and he was so interesting. And it occurred to me, Bob, at the time, I think he was 88 years old. He's 90 now. The time he's like 88 years old, and he's got every marble he was ever born with. He remembers everything. And I just think he's one of the real, real treasures. And I think you captured him in this long interview you did. So kudos to you.
It was an unfair. I was just shaking. The first 30 seconds, Peter, his voice just boomed across the phone line from his office at Winter Park in Eden Prairie, you know. I thought, wow. And then just, I mean, every answer, and he elaborated, and he was just, I don't have any scars, he said, Bob, because, you know, I've never been fired and never was cut. And every time you're fired, you get a scar. You know, it was just unreal stuff.
Yeah, that's so cool. Well, Bob, I originally wanted to have you on. I was thinking of getting you on with some of the other fellows who started their own sites, Paul Kuharsky in Nashville, Greg Bedard in Boston, and you, because just to ask about the experience, and I quite literally at some point this year was going to do that, but I woke up this morning and I said, there's only one person who can analyze what the injury of Aaron Rodgers means to the Green Bay Packers now that they have to play Brett Hundley. And so I just want to go over a few things about this, and then we'll get to other things about your life and about, you know, the state of our business. But I just want to get into Rodgers a little bit first, and I'm going to go in no particular order. Aaron Rodgers suffers a broken clavicle, a broken collarbone on Sunday in Minnesota, possibly knocking him out for the season. He did have a broken clavicle in 2013, but it was his left clavicle. And I know because I spoke to an orthopedic surgeon in New York today who specializes in shoulder surgeries, and he was telling me, he said, look, I don't know what happened. I would never say here's what they should do, anything like that. But he said, you're probably a little bit more likely to do surgery if it's on the throwing side of your body. And I said, why? And I said, because on the throwing side of your body, you want to make absolutely sure that when the bone fuses together, it is the exact same length of bone. You know, because sometimes when bones fuse together, they're not the exact same length, and you might have lost a few centimeters. And the reason why that's important on the throwing side of your body is that it could affect your throwing motion. If your clavicle is constricted and smaller, then it could affect how actually you throw the football. So he said you're more likely to have surgery when, if you're a right-handed quarterback, if your right clavicle is the one that's broken. So I didn't know that. And then I finished talking to him about a half hour later. I see the press release out of Green Bay that Rodgers indeed is going to have surgery, and the Packers are not putting a timeline on it. So, Bob, let me start by just asking about the play itself. You know, I found it a rather unremarkable play. When Anthony Barr took Aaron Rodgers down after that play, and Aaron Rodgers basically, although he stayed down, when he got up, you didn't see him wincing. I just thought maybe he just banged his shoulder a little bit, but I was so surprised when I heard he had a broken clavicle. How did you see it?
Barr, Peter, he was spying on the play. And I think Aaron misjudged his speed, and I don't think there's a better master of a game plan than Aaron Rodgers and a scouting report. But you remember in 2014, Peter, that Barr ran 4.46 at 255 pounds.
Wow.
Well, he was spying, just standing about 9 yards behind the line of scrimmage, and when after 2.7 seconds, when Rodgers broke right, then the chase immediate acceleration. And he moved forward those 12 yards so quickly that Rodgers, I think he just, you know, linebackers aren't that fast. And he got on him really quick, and he had to wait because lumbering Martellus Bennett had to clear on a bit of an over route on this bootleg action. And he just waited a bit too long. He threw a perfect pass that somehow Bennett managed to, you know, stonehand drop. The tackle, geez, it was a form tackle, Peter, head up. He was certainly, you know, Rodgers had removed himself from that two-step protection and low shield stuff. And I didn't see it as a driving of the body into the turf. He immediately just slid right off him. It's a tough thing. It's artificial turf over there. Certainly, you know, and he's a 255-pound man. The angle, their two bodies would have landed on that impact point about 475 pounds. I don't see it as dirty.
I didn't either. When I started hearing that today, I said, come on, this guy is sort of almost diving into the upper part of Rodgers' body, you know, trying to get a hand on the ball, and maybe if Rodgers pulls it back, trying to sack him or you know, tackle him. And I didn't think it was even remotely dirty. I was shocked when I started hearing that. Now, I think some of that might have come from, Bob, remember when you see Rodgers when he's coming off the field, he's kind of barking over his shoulder. It looks like he's saying something to Barr about the hit. You know, did you notice that?
Definitely. Yeah. Or to someone else on that Viking defense who may have said something.
Right.
I've heard some things about that, too. So I don't really know. I probably wouldn't have said anything if I was him, but I don't know what was said back. Maybe something was said in return. I've heard some stuff about that. So, you know, Peter, let me mention this, you know.
Yeah.
Aaron was off to a very good start. I mean, I've seen him have great starts. I wouldn't call it great, but I'd call it very good. He led the league in touchdown passes through 5 weeks. He led the league in something else, too, sacks taken. He had 19, and tied with him was Carson Palmer, the immobile one from out in Arizona. By my count, he also had been knocked down 16 times. And if you look at his numbers in both those categories over his entire career, they're all high. And he holds the ball. He takes a lot of sacks, and he also, when he extends plays, he lives a very dangerous life out there. Now, this play in question, everybody does this kind of thing. It's just an escape right. You throw the ball. You get hit by an extremely fast linebacker. But I want to bring a play up in the Atlanta game, Peter, with they're getting their brains beat in down there. They're down 11 with a minute left, and the ball's on the Green Bay 12. this game is over. This is garbage time. I'm amazed he's still in the lineup. But he is. Okay, so he shotgun. There's pressure in the middle. He spins out to his left. Now he's in his own end zone, okay? Just dump the ball, right, Peter? Just get rid of it. This is garbage time.
Yeah.
No. He holds it for 5.1 seconds, and here comes Adrian Claiborne, the defensive end, and absolutely levels him frontally. The pass flutters incomplete. He just gets drilled at the goal line. Now, he gets up. He's an extremely tough guy. But this stuff, I've written about this many times over the years, he takes too many chances for his own safety and for the health of the franchise. And maybe, I wrote today, the law of averages can catch up to you every 3 or 4 years. I mean, the bear, broken collarbone, and now this one.
This is the MMQB Podcast.
Hey everyone, this is ESPN's Adrian Wojnarowski, host of the Woj Pod. New NBA season is upon us. Perfect time to subscribe to the Woj Pod. Hear the biggest players, executives, coaches, legends of the game on the podcast. You can subscribe at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your shows. So subscribe to the Woj Pod. New episodes drop every Wednesday.
I don't know about you, but I do not like to shave. But who does? Nicks and scratches on your face? Those are not fun. And let's face it, razors are really expensive. At least I thought they were until I got my first package of razors from Harry's. Now, my story about Harry's, you may have heard this before, stop me if you've heard it, but the reason that I've really fallen for Harry's is that I am a shower shaver. And when you shave in the shower, a lot of times what happens is that handle of your razor really starts to get slippery. But the Harry's razor, I guess they call it ergonomic. I don't even know what that means. But all I know is that it doesn't slip out of my hands when I'm shaving in the shower, which I like because other razor handles over the years have slipped in the shower. And the other thing is, so I've been using Harry's now for, I don't know, at least a year. And the interesting thing about it is I come out of the shower, I look in the mirror, I'm never cut. And I have the kind of skin that I always used to get little dot cuts on my face, so little bloody cuts. Anyway, I like Harry's, so let me get on with the spot. You know, for decades, one big razor company relentlessly increased prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of its customers. So Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys who were fed up with getting ripped off, started Harry's to fix shaving. Harry's knew there was only one way to ensure quality, so they bought their own blade factory. By taking less profit and selling directly to you over the internet, Harry's offers their blades at half the price. So here's where it gets good for you. Harry's is so confident you'll love their blades, they're giving you their trial set for free. All you have to do is cover shipping. Now, your free trial set includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. That's a $13 value for you to try. All you've got to do is cover shipping. So stop messing around and get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your free trial offer, a $13 value for free, and all you do is cover the shipping. To get your free trial set, including a razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, and shave gel, go to harrys.com/king right now. That's harrys.com/king. Bob, I wonder, do you have any idea right now whether we'll see Aaron Rodgers the rest of this year?
The playoffs are about 12 or 13 weeks, you know, Peter, I think something like that. He returned from the last one in about 8. I just don't know. I don't know what to say. I mean, do you have a thought on it? You talked to that surgeon today.
Yeah, I think that my first reaction was when the Packers said, when they started introducing that it could be a season-ending injury. I mean, the Packers are the most conservative organization there is. When I heard that, I said, this is probably pretty severe. But then again, I'll also say this, that, you know, the surgeries that are done, and one of the things talking to this orthopedist today, the surgeries that are done are so incredibly precise. And it wouldn't surprise me if this thing heals in 10 weeks and he starts to throw and he tries to play again. But again, Bob, I would my only point about the Packers, and I pointed this out today in my column, is that the biggest reason for optimism is not, you know, how good Brett Hundley is. The biggest reason for optimism is that they got a pretty favorable schedule over the next, you know, say 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, is the biggest reason why I'd still have hope. I mean, do I think they're going to make the playoffs? No. I mean, the Vikings, in my opinion, right now, have three quarterbacks in their organization who are better today, right now, than anybody the Green Bay Packers have in their organization, obviously, now that Rodgers is going to be out. So I think the Vikings are going to win this division. But I'll ask you this. So America has no idea about Brett Hundley, fifth-round pick from UCLA. Mike McCarthy, in his press conference, said, hey, we've invested 3 years in Brett Hundley, and we're very confident in him and all that. And again, I'm not trying to be snide about this at all, but Brett Hundley had a very unimpressive day against the Vikings, and he's never started a game in the NFL. And his backup has never thrown a pass in the NFL, Joe Callahan from Wesley College in Dover, Delaware. So if I were the Packers, I'd be pretty darn nervous right now. How do you think they are, Bob?
Nervous but determined. You know, you got a head coach who's a quarterback expertise guy in his 12th year. That was his 200th game that he coached Sunday. He knows how to come back from stuff. He's got a good QB coach in Alex Van Pelt. Tom Clements is no longer here. I bet they wish they still had him. And Rodgers will be around to mentor. You know, continuity just permeates this entire organization, from the GM to the owner to everything, right? They feel pretty good about their system of football, their philosophy of how the game is coached and played. And I'd be very surprised if they don't win a lot of games. They moved the ball in 2013 when Rodgers missed those 8 games. They had 3 quarterbacks, and finally Matt Flynn bailed them out. But all those guys moved the ball. The problem was that year is their defense just collapsed. In those games Rodgers missed, the defense allowed 27, 27, 27, 26, 40, 21, 36, and 38. That can't happen again. Dom Capers was there then. He's here now. He's got to do a better job. But as you suggest, you look at that schedule, Hundley, I think, is going to be able to make some plays on the move. The action game will be good. McCarthy's got all that. He looked very good the preseason of his rookie year. He missed most of the second preseason with injury. And then this summer, he was average to a little above, I'd say. But he's capable. And now, you know, he should be a different player with the more reps he gets, and he'll get every rep in practice this week. You mentioned Callahan. I don't know, Mike McCarthy and Van Pelt really like this guy. I don't. I see him as a 6'1 guy who's slow of foot. I don't see it. But that's where they are, and I think they're stubborn, and they invest a tremendous amount of teaching time in their QBs, and they want to see it through with these two guys as long as there's no injury.
Yeah, I didn't see this, but somebody texted me, and because I wrote today, I said, listen, what harm can there be in simply calling Colin Kaepernick, in talking to Colin Kaepernick? This is not his style of offense necessarily and all that, but I just think, in my opinion, a phone call, an interview, find out where his head is, and not to take the job from Brett Hundley at all. Hundley's the quarterback, but Kaepernick might come in. He's got, I think I'm right in saying this, Bob, because they play a game against New Orleans this week, then have the bye. You'd have, of course, he would never be active this week anybody who they would bring in. They'd have two quarterbacks active for this game. But if you come in tomorrow, you got 19 days before anybody would even think, should we even think about activating a third quarterback? Not even to say that you would, but just to have him here. And look, I understand all of the mayhem that would surround doing it. Just, I am a different person, you know, when it comes to trying to improve my team. It's probably why I'm not Ted Thompson, why I'm not a general manager, because I'm sure Ted Thompson thinks of this and says, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard. But I don't know. I am of the opinion that you do what you can to try to make your team better. I would be with a team that has a chance to be a playoff team, even without Aaron Rodgers, in a weakened NFC, because I don't think the NFC is particularly strong this year. In a weakened NFC, if you get even C quarterback play, you got a pretty good chance to make the playoffs. I'd do whatever I could to get the best players, but that's just me. But anyway, I only bring that up because McCarthy evidently really chafed at it when somebody brought up, you have any interest in Kaepernick? And no, they didn't have any interest in Kaepernick in Green Bay, Wisconsin. So there you go. Bob, I would also just ask you, if you were to give me sort of a 20-second scouting report on Brett Hundley, what would you say?
When he came here, he wasn't a very good passer, you know? I mean, he was wild high a lot that first summer. Really wasn't seeing blitzes, NFL style. The first 2 weeks of that first training camp, there was a lot of terrible picks, and I was really shaking my head. But then he really turned it around in the middle of that first summer, and I think McCarthy and Clements and Van Pelt, they're really good quarterback developers. I mean, they are outstanding. They helped, you know, Aaron Rodgers, as we know, Peter, wasn't a player till really his third year, and they did tremendous work with him. They did Clements and McCarthy did tremendous work with Brett Favre in his two seasons with them. Two with them, and maybe had his greatest year ever with the Vikings, learning some of the things he had learned here. Hundley's pretty good on the move. He's a confident guy. I like that. He's got some brashness to him. I like that. He's got good size. He's got good foot speed. He can throw on the run quite well. He's just not a real accurate guy. And as you could see, I mean, he hadn't prepared for Mike Zimmer and these many different kind of blitzes, and he didn't react well to the blitzes. I think that'll come. He has the intellect to handle all that. I kind of like the guy. I talked to a lot of scouts about him at the end of his exhibition season this year because Rich Gannon, who does the analyst, he's the analyst on the Packer TV network, Gannon must have said three or four times that anybody out there needing a starting quarterback like Cleveland or the Jets should be calling Ted Thompson to go after Hundley. Well, I thought that was ridiculous because they needed Hundley as a backup. That's why he was drafted, yeah, to provide good protection behind Rodgers. And as it turned out, I was right. But the scouts I saw didn't see him as a starter, and his value would be mid to late round pick. That's what a couple of them said. But be that as it may, if he plays well now, Rodgers comes back next year, takes the job, then they could trade this guy. So there's a lot on the line for the organization and Hundley, but I do like him.
See, I am of the opinion that, you know, if you ask me about what's the one person since the draft, what is the personnel decision that was made that down the road will help a team the most? I would say Jacoby Brissett going from New England to Indianapolis in trade for Philip Dorsett, the wide receiver. The reason I say that is that Jacoby Brissett, under contract for 3 years at an average of $720,000 a year, he's an incredibly smart and economical insurance policy for Andrew Luck. And Andrew Luck has needed an insurance policy, you know, in his short career in the NFL.
Yeah.
But it's not only that. It's just the fact that this guy was, you know, in the crucible with the New England Patriots and, you know, saw Tom Brady. A lot of Tom Brady rubbed off on Jacoby Brissett. A lot of Bill Parcells, who was a mentor for Jacoby Brissett, rubbed off. You know, the Colts really didn't know what they were getting. But you know what they got? They got the 24th best starting quarterback in the NFL. And in saying that, he's obviously not primed to be a starter in Indianapolis, but he is exactly what you want in your backup quarterback, a guy who you think can go in and win some games for you, a guy who doesn't cost very much money, and a guy all he cares about is helping the team win. And that, to me, is the perfect backup. And again, I don't think the Colts have any intention of trading him. You know, he's going to be the backup this year when Luck comes back, and he'll be the backup next year for Luck. Who knows what happens in 2019? But my feeling is that the backup quarterback position does not garner enough attention from teams. And I think that the Jacoby Brissett trade was brilliant. And, you know, to me, in my opinion, if the Green Bay Packers, if Brett Hundley, you know, plays 90% as well as Jacoby Brissett, the Packers could win 11 games and make the playoffs and maybe even host a home game. That's just my feeling.
Mm-hmm. They're going to have to do it on defense, Peter, you know, and I just don't know if they're good enough there. I didn't, you know, it's just that was the big question on this team to start with.
Bob, let's before we part, let's get to just a couple of other areas. So, you went out on your own. You went into business with your son. And I wonder, what is the biggest difference between covering a team every day and actually being in business and still covering the team, but covering it in a vastly different way?
My own boss, for the first time in 42 years, you know, I sent an email to my son who is in national sales, and you know Charlie, national sales in Milwaukee, and he loves sports, but, you know, he's not a writer per se. So he handles the business end, and I sent him a note explaining some of the stories I had planned for next week, and there were some complications with the Bud Grant interview, and he responds, you don't need to tell me, read the name of the name of our website, you know. I guess that's right. I can kind of do what I want. So I don't have I had great people at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel all those years. I had terrific sports editors, and I loved bouncing ideas off them. Well, that's gone. However, I do have Mark Eckel, the longtime Philadelphia Eagle beat writer in Trenton, who won that beat for years and years, one of the most aggressive guys I know, a real news hound. And Mark is our I've titled him our copy chief, Peter, to get an old newspaper term there, right? And so I can bounce a lot of stuff off Mark, and that's fun. And he's followed the Packers as kind of a closet fan for many years.
Yeah.
The deadlines, you know? I mean, if I want to go for a walk with my wife at 8 p.m., I don't have to worry about a 9:30 deadline. I mean, I can make it 12. I can make it midnight, you know?
Yeah.
Like tonight, I'll be doing that. That's been good. In terms of the editing process, I'm going to miss the editing of Mike Davis, my wonderful sports editor in Milwaukee, and I miss that already. He really makes copy sing sometimes, and it helped my stuff, so I miss that. What else? I'm not traveling, Peter, and I certainly love that. It's tough. You know, I live in Green Bay, and it was always a connecting flight everywhere I go except Detroit and Minneapolis. And
is it really different covering a game by watching it on television instead of being in the stadium and watching there?
Yes, because I can't put my eyes where I want them to go. it's extremely frustrating. I mean, I want to watch the safeties on every snap. Well, I can't ever watch the safeties, you know.
What about when the all 22 tape becomes available during the week? Do you still do that?
I do some of that, but because I have to analyze the Packer game on the day after, that's not available yet.
Yeah.
So on certain key plays, I'll go back to it, but most of mine is the TV analysis is still off that TV tape.
Yeah.
So the tight close-ups on the quarterback's face for 10 seconds, but you know, before the snap, it just drives you nuts. I want to see stuff, and that's not the stuff I want to see.
Yeah.
But I've been in a lot of press boxes, Peter, and you know, we were not credentialed by the Packers. Bob McGinn Football was denied credentials by them.
Did they ever give you a reason why?
Well, I don't want to speak for them, Peter.
Yeah.
And so that wouldn't be fair of me. So that's just, if they ever want to discuss it, they may, but I'm not going to get into that.
Are there questions that, and I'll use Aaron Rodgers as an example, are there questions that you wish you could ask him that now, because your access is not there, that you can't?
Yes. Yeah. What I really miss is being able to have one-on-one interviews with Packers and players on the visiting team on game days. I love that one-on-one interaction with all kinds of players. I've met so many players on visiting teams over the years. And, you know, my regulars in Green Bay. That's a negative. But it's really a minor setback. You know, most of my work is done on the phone. And
right. Well, I've always thought that most of your work is not sort of the glad handy backslapping, group interviews at lockers. You know, you've just never been that guy. I mean, Paul Zimmerman was a lot like that. Paul Zimmerman always, you know, wanted to get players by himself. He always wanted to talk to the linemen because he thought that's where the game was always won or lost. And you're like that too. So honestly, Bob, when I heard that you didn't have locker room access and you were not granted credentials, I was disappointed for you. But I don't think there's a soul who reads you to find out if you could get something good out of Aaron Rodgers. You know, they read you because they want to know, why did we win? Why did we lose?
Yeah. I hope you're right, Peter. And, I'm well rested when I'm writing.
Yeah.
I'm not fighting that horrible deadline in a press box, just running, you know, heart racing, just stressed out beyond belief. Did that for 40 years. That gets a little old. Half those games, I couldn't even make it to the locker room anyway because of these horrible night deadlines.
Yeah.
So, I'm rested. I have time. I feel I'm writing better right now. It's really been invigorating and motivating and exciting to be working with my son as well.
How's the business part of it? And, I mean, can businesses like your business and Greg Bedard's and Paul Kuharsky, I know you guys are, you're different people and you have different ways of doing this and different responsibilities, but I wonder, how do you look at the business that has changed so much that now has people going out on their own like this?
I think the model is there if your content is good, but it's got to be good, it's got to be unique, it's got to be different. And I've always tried to be those things. I didn't always succeed in the newspaper world, but I always tried, and that's what I'm trying to do now. I try to personalize my coverage even more than I have in the past. We're a subscription-based model. So, I mean, we all know, Peter, asking people to pay for news, it can be a difficult thing. Fortunately, I cover a team that has millions of fans worldwide and knows me. I hope I have a name. And they know that I'll tell them about that number five cornerback, what he runs, what his test score is. And they know I respect their knowledge, and that's what I'll provide. We don't have any sponsors. Some other of the guys that you mentioned do have sponsors and advertisers. We're not at that point yet. Our numbers have been very good, and that may come at some point. You got to be professional. You got to be a journalist, and you have to differentiate yourself in some way.
What worries you about the business right now?
The business as a whole, right?
Yes.
Young writers not really having a chance to work with veteran editors as we did on newspapers, to learn to be maybe thrown into beats at such young ages. I didn't get on that Packer beat full time till I was 32, and I love covering high schools and small colleges first. Those are some of my best days, and you learn all that, and then you work up to pro sports. And I don't know. I like the seasoning process a lot of us had. The group journalism, and I feel on newspaper, everybody has to comment immediately on these things. You and I, Peter, we report the news, and we were taught to report the news, and then a columnist comments, or later, 4 or 5 days later, when you can think. Isn't that a novel idea? Actually think right about what you're writing. And so I read some things online, and it's kind of drivel, you know? It's just so
right,
just quick, knee-jerk reaction. I don't need that, and I don't think readers are served by that very well.
Yeah, it's a very tough gig now because I think that, you know, I find myself sometimes running the MMQB. I worry about if people Google Aaron Rodgers clavicle, and they just put that in Google and they hit enter. I want to find a way for the MMQB's story on Aaron Rodgers' injury to come up first. And believe it or not, Bob, there's a lot of energy and time invested in things like that because, honestly, if you enter Aaron Rodgers' clavicle and hit enter and you're on Google, well, if you see 15 stories come up on the first page, you're going to do what? You're going to click on the first one. And so
right,
if you, and it doesn't matter who wrote it, doesn't matter who did it, as long as they, you know, the headline is something about here's the injury to Aaron Rodgers. So in other words, a lot of times some of this stuff, it doesn't matter at all what the quality of your work is. What it matters is whether you can figure out to get your work to be on top of the pile. As insane as that sounds, there are people who work for Time Inc. who are in business of trying to figure out how to make that happen. Mm. And, you know, so, I mean, look, to say the business has changed, I mean, I was telling this to somebody the other day. This would have been 20 years ago, maybe 21 years ago. Brett Favre, the MVP quarterback of the Green Bay Packers, is going into rehab for Vicodin addiction. And I'll never forget this. He had asked me, he called me, you know, maybe a month prior to this, and he said, hey, I'm starting a golf tournament for my foundation in Biloxi, Mississippi. Is there any way you would come and play in this golf tournament? And, you know, being a foursome, I said, I'm terrible at golf, but if it's important, I'll go. So he said, yeah, I'd really love you to go. So I said, okay, I'll go. So I arranged to go down there, and then I believe it was on a Tuesday late afternoon, the announcement comes out, Favre to enter the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas, to treat his Vicodin addiction. And every jaws drop everywhere around the United States. You know, the state of Wisconsin all puts on black armbands. Oh, my God, you know, it's an awful thing. And so I figured to myself, well, I guess the tournament's off. Favre calls me that night and tells me, yeah, I'm going in, but we're still going to do the tournament. There's a lot of charities that are dependent on the money we were going to raise. Would you still come? And I said, yeah, I'll come. And I said, hey, as long as I got you on the phone. And I said, can you just tell me this story? And so, you know, Favre, I don't know that he ever once said in his life, hey, off the record, you know. And so he just told me the whole story for about 40 minutes. And I get off the phone and I say, hey, listen, I wish you the best. I really am pulling for you. I hope it goes okay. Blah, blah, blah. I get off the phone. Bob, it's Tuesday night at about maybe 9 o'clock at night. Sports Illustrated, the magazine, goes to bed every Monday at 6 p.m. We have no, there's no website, there's no anything else. I work for one entity, Sports Illustrated.
The magazine.
And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, he's going to tell somebody this story, and I'm going to get beat on my own story. And Bob, I wait, and I wait. And I wait, and I go to the golf tournament, and I talk to people there about this, and I wait, and I wait. And I tell everybody at the magazine, I'm going to have a really good story about Favre and his addiction and all that stuff, and I'll file it Sunday morning. And so that's exactly what I did. I went to the golf tournament, interviewed some people there, interviewed Deanna, who was then his fiance, now his wife. And so, Bob, and I wait. And I wait, and I wait. And Bob, the magazine comes out on Thursday morning, and that's the first that anybody in the United States ever heard from Brett Favre. Bob, 8 days. 8 days that thing waited. Can you believe 8 days that nobody, that story just sat there for 8 days? I felt like I was in the Old West. You know, trying to get a piece of mail. Didn't that take about 8 days to go by stagecoach? Well, this story basically goes, you know, unreported for 8 days, and finally it comes out. It's the story of the week, story of the month. It's an incredible story. And I tell people that, ladies and gentlemen, is the difference in the business in just one generation. Just one generation. That's what happened. Because today, if you find that out, you better have everything that he just told you in the public sphere within an hour, or else you're old, man. There you go.
There were none of these information guys, Peter, you know, these national people who are on top of everything. That they didn't exist.
Well, McDonough existed right around that time. He was just coming in to prominence then, you know.
Yep, but, okay.
Yeah. Anyway. Hey, okay. Bob, listen, I really, really appreciate you taking the time, educating us a little bit about, A, the business, B, Rogers, C, Hundley, D, everything else in life that I don't know. So I'm really appreciative for you giving us a few minutes today.
Completely my pleasure, old friend. Thank you very much, Peter.
You're listening to the MMQB Podcast.
State Farm knows that for football fans, your car and home are more than just stuff. They're some of your most valuable possessions. The things you've worked hard for and made a lifetime of memories with. Whether it's the truck that gets you to every tailgate, or the place where you watch your favorite team with your favorite people. But life can be a real tough opponent. That's why when it comes to finding the right home and auto insurance, you need a strong defense. A seasoned pro like State Farm. Because they understand it's more than just a car or a house. So why not give it the protection it deserves? It's just one more way they're here to help life go right. See how they can help you by talking to a State Farm agent today. And now my conversation with Brad Sham. Back on the MMQB podcast with the voice of the Dallas Cowboys, Brad Sham. We're here at Dallas Cowboys training camp. I'm not sure exactly when we will use this conversation, but when I saw Brad here in Oxnard, California, at Cowboys camp, I said, Brad is such a good storyteller. We really, really have to get him on. So anyway, Brad, thanks a lot for joining me.
It's an honor to be on the best with the best. Thank you.
Well, thank you. So, Brad, I want you, the first thing I really want to ask you about is you've been doing the Dallas Cowboys since 19...
Middle of the 76 season, 3 years removed to do the Texas Rangers, so the math doesn't add up. This is my 39th season, my 38th training camp. I started 1 year before Merrill Reese started with the Eagles, but he's got 2 years on me because of the 3 years I did the Texas Rangers.
What'd you think of doing the Rangers?
You know,
was that at the old Arlington ballpark?
It was, the new one was 2 years old.
Okay.
And I got into the business at the age of 16 in high school, hoping to be a baseball announcer.
Wow.
And it's a different life. As you know, someone who's covered the game, follows the game, that, you know, we think of this as 24/7 in season, but that's every single day. It's just relentless. Now, if you love baseball, it's fine. It's
what hard. Years did you do the Rangers?
95, 6, and 7. They never went to the playoffs until I was on their broadcast team.
Wow.
And so the first playoff game I ever did was at the old Yankee Stadium.
Wow.
I mean, how cool is that for a kid who's a baseball fan?
Yeah. Wow. So how did you like doing baseball?
Oh, I loved it. I think it's the hardest sport to do well because the rhythms are so different than anything else. It's the only team sport we have where the action doesn't automatically stop for a score. You can have nothing happen, it's hot, let me have a beer, nothing happen, all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
And you cannot be flummoxed.
Yeah.
You have to remember when it's the seventh inning and it's 2.5 hours into the game and it's 100 degrees outside, there's runners at first and second, and the ball goes in the gap, and you have to remember who's on first so you can identify the fact that Peter King is now rounding second and headed for third after the other guy just scored. You have to remember all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds easy. We all think we can do it. It's the hardest thing to do well.
Yeah. I have a great memory of the Dallas Cowboys broadcast team. One day when you guys had a game at the Meadowlands, and I walked over there, and there in your broadcast booth was Dan Rather.
Yeah,
and I said, man, I need to go listen to this. So
well,
I did.
I'll tell you something else about that. So that was the year that Troy Aikman retired, and we knew that they were going to not be good. So we said before the season started, what can we do that will give people a reason to listen? So, because the team may not sustain that. So we decided to come up with somebody in every league city who either had played for the team or had some name recognition. Now, in Dan's case, he was in New York. You know, we knew he were, I say we, the people at the radio station at the time, we knew he was a Texan. We knew he'd done some football as a youngster. We were a CBS affiliate. He was with CBS, and he was as intrigued as you would imagine that he would be.
Lived in New York, obviously.
He lived in New York. Clint Sterner was the quarterback for the Cowboys that day, and we've got tapes of, you know, Rather sitting there talking about, you know, this would be a good place for a button hook. And nobody says button hook anymore.
Yeah.
And I'll be a son of a gun if the next play
isn't
is not
a quick curl.
It's a hook. It's a quick curl. And Rather, now he's all excited. But I'll tell you something else about that season that was fun. Those were the regular season games. Preseason, my partner Babe Loffenberg, who had a very nice pension obtaining career as a quarterback in the NFL, does preseason TV. So I'm talking to Rich Dalrymple, the Cowboys vice president of public relations, in the spring, and I said, we got to find someone to fill in. And we were opening in Oakland. And Rich said, Madden might do it. He's not working that day. He's got a box. Long story short, the first, and you can ask him, the only first and only game John Madden ever did on the radio.
Was on your team?
Was our preseason, me and John, the preseason opener of 2001, whatever year that was. He comes in overalls and, you know, a baseball cap on backwards. He doesn't care what he looks like. He doesn't have to. He's not on television. He's got, you know, Velcroed sneakers. Early in the game, I said, John, I know you probably miss working with the Telestrator. We haven't got one of those on radio, but here, and I gave him an Etch-A-Sketch. And he had more fun playing with that. And it was Quincy Carter's first game. You remember how excited Jerry was about Quincy Carter. And so there's like inside the two-minute warning of the first half. A little bit of a lull like you get, especially in a preseason opener. And we're just kind of breathing, and John says, Troy Aikman. And I thought, oh, John. And so I said on the air, John, you know, Troy's not playing anymore. He said, no, I know. I just didn't think it would be right to have the day go by without somebody mentioning Troy Aikman. So I did.
That's really good.
It's one of the most fun afternoons I've ever had.
So, Brad, one of the things that I have always thought about radio crews, local radio crews that do NFL teams, is that you really want to make people turn the sound down on TV to listen to you. And I'll give you a great example of this. I married a girl from Pittsburgh, and when I used to go visit their home, they had Myron Cope and Bill Hillgrove on the radio, and they never had the the NBC crew doing the Steelers on TV. Now, this was a dyed-in-the-wool Steeler fan family. On the rabbit ear TV antenna hung a terrible towel. So these are the real fans. And I thought, what an honor for Myron Cope it must be. And I once told Myron that they did that, and he goes, wow. He said, that's what we really aim to do. We want everybody to listen to us. So my question to you is that a goal of yours? And how do you know how many people turn down the sound to listen to you?
Well, the short answer to the second question is you don't. People, there's fancy surveys and measurables, and I don't know what any of it means, but we know it's a significant number. The ironic thing is that as technology has improved, I mean, here we are sitting in an office in Oxnard, California, with a laptop and what it looks like a tape recorder, but it isn't because there's no tape. It's all digital. And this is going to be put somewhere in the stratosphere where someone in Bangor, Maine can listen to it in November if they want to, whenever it runs right. The first time. With all the advances in technology, it's actually harder now to do that, turn down the sound, because there are so many different ways the television picture is delivered. It's not one standard way. When you were in your then girlfriend's home and that they were watching on the rabbit ears,
it was simultaneous,
how
right?
Yes, and that's how people watch television. But now sometimes they get it digitally. Sometimes they get it. A few still do it that way. Sometimes it's
so. What you're saying is that so what you're saying is
technology doesn't sync.
Yeah, I
automatically.
See. Wow.
And what we hear more than anything else is we turn down the sound, but sometimes it's hard. I mean, DirecTV is not the same as Dish. And
yeah.
One cable system is different from another cable system. And what we hear more than anything else is we try to turn down the sound, but you're always either fill in the blank ahead of or behind
yeah.
the play. But people still do it. And in the 80s, CBS Radio was doing the Monday night games, and that was a major campaign. And before Howard Cosell stopped doing the games, Howard, as you recall, was a polarizing figure. Some loved him, more hated him. And CBS Radio had Jack Buck and Hank Stram, and they ran a very popular and specific campaign. Turn down the sound and listen to Jack and Hank. And was aimed at.
And I thought they were really good, by the way.
And they were.
Yeah.
I got the chance to do a few of those games with Hank, and it was. And Jack Buck was one of my heroes, so that was a real honor to be able to sit in that booth. Well, our station in Dallas was a CBS affiliate, and so we just adopted that network phrase and said, turn down the sound. The Cowboys play the Rams this week. Turn down the sound and turn up KRLD. And people did, and people still do. And the reason they do it is that when network announcers do the game, they're talking to people in Portland, Oregon, and Portland, Maine.
Right.
And they have to play it down the middle, and they cannot be even though they are privy to usually more information than anyone else. Coaches, owners, everyone wants to kiss up to the network TV announcers, and they'll tell them lots of stuff. there's nothing like being with the team every day. There's nothing like knowing the players, seeing them every day, the coaches, and that's why I'm on the field before the game starts, about 2 hours before the game.
What do you do 2 hours before the game?
I am on the field because my experience is counterintuitive, though it strikes me. Up until 2 hours before the game, even coaches and players who know you and trust you are reluctant to tell you anything. 2 hours before the game, they may open a vein.
Right.
And they'll tell you everything. And, I mean, they have to trust you that you're not going to. But you can really get insight that our team's fans care about. How's this guy going to be used today? What formation are they going to play? How's that injury? Who's mad at who? And those are things that, and so, you know, Babe Laufenberg, my broadcast partner, played the game a long time. I think we have the very best sideline reporter, Christy Scales. Christy has a great way of making friends with the assistant coaches. She will. You watch her throughout the year when you see us. She'll be talking to Rod Marinelli before the game, and they probably are talking for a long time about his grandchildren. And she knows everything about what all of his grandchildren are doing, and he gives her books to read. And, oh, by the way, she'll know every defensive line rotation. She'll know every muscle pull that a guy had. She'll know every formation they don't want a certain guy in.
What's interesting about that is it's almost – because I've talked to many sideline reporters over the years at NFL games. Now, the NFL is different, I think, from college football. The NFL is very restrictive on sideline information, okay? You can't report this. You can't report that. If you overhear a conversation, you're not supposed to report that. I get that. So to have a sideline reporter give out real information is such a bonus.
So the thing that's different, I can only speak for us, but so I won't say all radio, but I certainly will say for our approach from television is in and out. We trust her. We don't need, there's no pre-produced pieces. She knows the game. She knows the people. She knows what her job is. If she tells the producer, I need it, she needs it. She's going to have something that's going to go bang, and it might be funny, but it might be really insightful. And I would say, at least 45 or 50% of the time, it's about an injury, and we are ahead of network television. A lot of times, network sideline reporters find out from Christy what the injury was.
Do you ever get frustrated that you know so much about your team and you impart so much on your team, but because so many people watch the television broadcast and don't listen to you, that your stuff oftentimes gets lost in the ether?
I'm going to, let me tell you, no, the answer is no, never, ever. And here's why. I got into this business because when I was a teenager, I'm a Chicagoan, and I'm a teenager, and I'm watching the Cubs one day and the White Sox the next day, or sometimes both of them in the same day. And I literally had an epiphany at about the age of 12 or 13. The guys that I'm hearing announce the game, they're at the ball game every day. I want to go to the ball game every day. It had nothing to do with making a living, making money. I want to go to the ball game. Peter, I'm going to the ball game every day. When I go to practice, and I love the preparation. I love preparing for a preseason game. God help me. I love every aspect of it. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. And so that day of preparation, the day of practice in Oxnard, the building of my first depth chart for the Hall of Fame game, that's going to the ball game for me. I'm going to the ball game every day. How could I possibly get frustrated?
Very good point. With Brad Sham, the veteran voice of the Dallas Cowboys. Brad, you've known Jerry Jones now since the day he took over ownership of this team, 1989. And he's one of the most polarizing figures in all of sports and certainly in your Metroplex. And he enters the Hall of Fame this year. And it's interesting that depending on who you talk to, both in Dallas and around the country, he's either liked, revered, or reviled. And I think in many cases, he is reviled. So what's your relationship with Jerry Jones? What's your thought about him as to his importance to the game and what he has meant to the game?
My relationship with him is good. I've never been to his home. We don't go hang out. I think he understands that, especially at this point, after a certain number of years, there are some things that I might bring to the broadcast that are helpful. The owners aren't listening to the radio either. They're like the TV viewers you were talking about a minute ago. So it tickles me that every few years he'll hear a highlight or someone will say something to him and he will discover me again. And every few years he'll say, you know, you're pretty good. And I'll say, well, thanks, Jerry. I appreciate that. But we have a good relationship, and I think that he has been a terrific owner of the Cowboys. As far as being in the Hall of Fame, for me, he's not in the Hall of Fame because he owns the Dallas Cowboys. Now, he wouldn't be in the Hall of Fame if he didn't own the Dallas Cowboys. He wouldn't be in the Hall of Fame if they hadn't won those three Super Bowls, although it was 25 years ago. But that's not why he's in the Hall of Fame. He is a contributor. You know this better than me. He's a contributor. And you guys established that parameter, that description of the category of contributor. And to me, by any objective viewpoint, Jerry Jones has positively impacted the way we, as fans, experience professional football. I felt that way about Tex Schramm, who was a complete visionary. And so Tex discovered some things that were already discovered. Jerry couldn't discover them. Tex had done it. Lamar Hunt was a visionary. So Jerry has changed the way all of us as fans experience professional football in terms of television, marketing, stadia. 15 years from now, when the L.A. Stadium is built and the NFL has established an NFL West and the NFL Network has its dazzling NFL L.A. complex, those will have Jerry's fingerprints all over them. That wouldn't have happened that way without Jerry Jones. He is unquestionably a Hall of Fame contributor to the game of professional football in America, and in North America, I would say.
You know, a few more minutes with Brad Schamm. Brad, I've often wondered this about a guy who would be the voice of a team that is revered far and wide. And I wonder if you ever hear from the folks in Alpine, Texas, if you ever hear from the folks in Eagle Pass, Texas, in Del Rio, Texas, in Pecos, Texas, you know, all over the map of people who get your games on the radio.
By the way, small towns in Louisiana, Arkansas, and New Mexico as well.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it right now. Farmington, New Mexico. Roswell, New Mexico. Shreveport. Hugo, Louisiana. Or Hugo, Oklahoma. Pardon me, Hugo. And I just wonder, do you hear from those people, and do you realize the reach that you have?
Sure. And it's got nothing to do with me. I mean, it's the Dallas Cowboys. It's been that way. There were a couple of years in the late 70s, early 80s. Again, technology and media are completely different. Tex Schramm had it in mind, and one year he did it, to have a radio affiliate in every state in the union.
Wow.
And one year we did. We had one in Hawaii. I heard from those people. Yeah. And the thing that you said before about the relationship between hometown broadcasters and the audience, and I think it's true in every sport. It's probably most true in baseball, but I think it's true in every sport. There's a familiarity, and there is a trust if you do the job right, and people allow you into their cars, garages, duck blinds, wherever it is. Those are the people I imagine I'm speaking to. Sightless people, truck drivers, people cleaning out the garage, people driving trucks. Knowing full well that I'm talking to people, some of them in the stadium, some of them who are watching on television. But those are the people that I try to be talking to. Now, for the people in the smaller towns that you mentioned, Eagle Pass, Pecos, we're, Babe and Christy and I, we are their connection. We're their link to the team. And people are very generous and say things all the time like, well, you're as important as anything. Well, no, we're not. But I understand that we're your link. We're your connector. And I respect that. I really do, because I'm a fan. Most of us are fans first. So I idolized players, but Jack Brickhouse was my hero. Jack Buck was my role model. Those, and I understood that they understood what their job was, which was to respect the game, describe it accurately, have fun, because there's a line three times around the stadium of people who will do it free. And be honest. Be respectful. Be honest that you can be critical if you're fair. Vern Lundquist, I was Vern's albatross for 8 years, in my first 8 years on the broadcast, and Vern and I used to joke all the time that we do the games objectively from the Cowboys' point of view. And that's still my goal.
Yeah.
That is still my goal. I don't think anybody who hears one of our broadcasts, and now, thanks to Sirius and XM and satellite, and, you can hear them anywhere.
Yeah.
Streaming. I don't think anybody who hears any of our broadcast questions that I'm for the Cowboys winning the game that day. And I also don't hide my disgust well. And so the people in Eagle Pass, if a guy does something dumb, I'm not talking about a physical mistake, if there's a dumb play, now I don't like to use the word dumb because it's a little pejorative, but you can certainly suggest that play was not up to the standards that the Cowboys would like to establish, and that's what the guy in Eagle Pass is thinking. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's the bond that we have with all of the listeners of the radio network, wherever they are.
So you obviously have to be a truth teller. And I wonder, could you see hope in 1989? Could you see hope in Jimmy Johnson's first year, 1-15? And I'm sure, Brad, let's go back in time and let's just set the stage. You've got at least half, and I'm sure much more, of your listening audience who's angry at this oil man who comes in and he whacks Tom Landry and Tex Schramm, and, you know, this is a blight on our society, this rube coming in, firing everybody, bringing in this dumb college coach. So I wonder, what was that year like, and how did you sense the anger and the vitriol?
Well, I sensed the anger and the vitriol because I was doing a call-in show every night. And I wish you hadn't brought this up now because it takes longer
than
we have
time. That's
okay,
say it.
You're going to edit it. No, it's just, you know, Jerry Jones will give you a number of reasons to dislike him if that's what you want to do. But I think something you said before is accurate. Most people who revile Jerry Jones do it somehow tied to his dismissal of Tom Landry.
Right.
And I always say, let's see how much you know. Because Tex Schramm wanted to get rid of Tom Landry.
Wow.
But
I didn't know that.
Well, I wrote a little book in 2003 called Stadium Stories, different things about the Cowboys, unrelated to each other, except that they're about the Cowboys. And one of the chapters I did was on Tex, and it was about 6 months before he died. Now, I'd known him 35 years, but I spent a whole day with him, and he told me things that I didn't know. 1986, Landry says to Schramm, get ready. Get the next guy.
Wow.
I'm thinking about it. Landry hires the hottest young assistant coach in the NFL, Paul Hackett, from the San Francisco 49ers.
Wow.
In typical Tex Schramm / Jerry Jones fashion, Schramm announces the hiring of Paul Hackett on the day of the NBA All-Star Game in Dallas in February, and the Dallas Morning News and the Dallas Times-Herald have, above the fold in the sports section, Cowboys hire Hackett. And below the fold, NBA All-Star Game tonight. Right? He hired Hackett because Landry said, get the next guy ready. Landry then proceeded to change everything Hackett did. And that was also the year Herschel Walker got dropped in their lap in the middle of training camp. Landry then decides, without telling anyone, he's not going to quit. And either 87 or 88 in the spring, Landry holds a press conference. Schramm had Marty Schottenheimer in. He told me this. It's in the book. He had Marty Schottenheimer in Dallas showing him houses.
Wow.
He thought he was going to hire Marty Schottenheimer to replace Tom Landry, who was going to retire. Landry comes and has a press conference, and that's when Schramm finds out that Landry's not quitting.
Wow.
Landry says, there's been a lot of speculation about my future, and I just want to tell everybody that I'm staying, and I'm coaching. I hope to coach into the 90s, and we all thought he meant his 90s. Wow. And that's how Schramm found out. So you talk about the 89 team. Was it hard to watch the 89 team? No. The 88 team, Landry's last team that got old and was 3-13 in my 39 years.
Team,
that's
huh?
the worst Cowboys team I've ever seen. 89, wow. They're tearing it down to build it up.
Right.
We all knew what to expect.
Right.
People then say, Jerry Jones. I hate Jerry Jones. Why do you hate Jerry Jones? Tell me if it's got anything to do with firing Tom Landry. Well, yes. Okay, great. So here's the backstory. Schramm wanted to get rid of him, but he couldn't because Clint Merkison, the original owner's deal was Schramm, Landry, Brandt, that's a set. They can break themselves up. Nobody else can break them up.
That's really interesting.
Two people, I've been told that, and I've been had this confirmed by one of the people involved, two people offered more money for the franchise to Bum Bright than Jerry Jones. He turned them both down because they were both going to keep Tom Landry. And Bum Bright hated Tom Landry.
Wow.
Jerry gets the team. Everybody knows Jerry's bringing his guy.
Yep.
Now, the same people who are calling my radio show every night in the fall of 1988, I'm not talking about occasionally, Peter. He's old. He's senile. The game is, which he wasn't. The yeah. game has passed him by. You've got to get rid of Landry. Okay, here comes Jerry Jones. He gets rid of Landry. How can you get rid of Landry? Well, that's fans.
Yeah.
He's from Arkansas. He seemed a little too pleased for some people's taste about the whole thing. Now, my next question is, okay, Tom Landry was a guy that Tex Schramm wanted to replace. Tom Landry was a guy who, by his own later admission, was struggling with some of the sociological challenges of the people who were playing pro football in 1987 and 8. So you've decided we're going to replace Tom Landry. Now, you go ahead. Tell me the right way to do it.
There is no right way.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's no right way.
So
yeah.
Jerry Jones says, so Bum Bright says, I'll fire him for you. And Jerry says, no, I'm going to fly down and tell him face to face. Well, people don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't make Jerry a villain.
Right.
So Jerry goes down, flies down to Lakeway where Tom's playing golf, flies down with Schramm, who's incredibly uncomfortable about the whole thing, and he says, we're making a change. Now, I wasn't there. I didn't hear it. My suspicion, what you want to know is that Jerry said, Tom, we want to build you a statue, which they subsequently did. You know, we want to name everything in the world after you. We're going to make a change. Tom essentially says no. Look it up and see when Tom Landry went in the Ring of Honor. Tom Landry turned down going in the Ring of Honor about three times.
Wow.
Because he was still mad.
Right.
And everybody gets that.
Yeah.
But Jerry tried to honor him along the way and met with resistance from Tom and his family. There's no right way to fire Tom Landry. And yet it was what everybody wanted done, and it was what everyone agreed had to happen. They just wanted him to step away gracefully, and he didn't want to. The great irony to me, Peter, was that was what he did with his players. He intentionally, Tom Landry intentionally, did not have close personal relationships with most of his players while they were playing because he knew the day would come that he would have to cut them. And all of his players, I say all, 85-90%, they didn't like him when they played for him. When they were done, they looked back and said, wow, look at, and they were close to him, and they never knew that he knew the names of all of their children. He cared about them deeply, but he thought, this is the way I have to run a business.
You know what,
and then it happened to him, and he didn't like it.
You know, I often found that a lot of coaches are exactly like that. Joe Paterno always used to say, it's about the kids, it's about the kids. And then he's coaching so long, he's taking naps during practice. You know, it wasn't about the kids, it was about Joe. But anyway, be that as it may. I do want to just tell you one thing about Tech Schramm, and you'll get a great kick out of this. My first assignment when I'm hired at Sports Illustrated in June 1989, they said, hey, listen, there's this new football league called the World League of American Football. Tech Schramm is running this league, and he's going on a search for franchises. So we want you to go with him for 4 or 5 days around the country.
What a trip that must have been.
So we're in a I go to Dallas, and I get in this plane. And there's Tex, there's Joe Bailey.
Joe Bailey.
Okay. And there's
Billy Hicks.
Billy Hicks was there. Yep. And there's two. So there's a few people in this plane. And so we're flying. We go to Birmingham, Alabama. We go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Charlotte for Jerry Richardson to woo the World League of American Football. We go to Orlando. We go to Raleigh. We did not on that trip. Okay. We didn't go to San Antonio. But here's what I'll always remember. One of the stops on it that I just forgot to say was in Nashville. And so we were in every one of the things. I got down first. I got off the plane first because a lot of times there was the mayor and there were some local dignitaries, and I just wanted to see what they said to each other. Maybe I would use it, maybe whatever. And so I got off the plane in Nashville, and I look over, and there's the man in black. And this guy sticks his hand out to me, and he goes,
Hi, I'm Johnny Cash.
I'm Johnny Cash. Welcome to Nashville. And so then they come down the plane, and Tech Schramm comes down, and he goes, Johnny! you know, that really was an indoctrination. And what was most interesting about Tech Schramm, who I knew but didn't know great, what was amazing is that I don't know how old Tex was at the time. I'm guessing 65. I don't know, something like that. Maybe even 70, but I will never forget. He was always the last one to bed.
Oh, yeah.
On every night on that trip, we were in some bar, and I said, oh, my God, this guy can really
live.
Let
me ask you something. Who does that remind you of?
Gerald Wayne Jones.
I said this to Charlotte Anderson, the Cowboys vice president, one of the most capable businesswomen in America right now. I said this to her 2 days ago as we tape this. If I could have 5 wishes, one of them would be to bring Tex back so that he and Jerry could sit together now. There was too much animosity when Jerry bought the team. Jerry hadn't accomplished the things that he has now accomplished. You know, they were both angry at each other's But now, I've told Rich Dalrymple and members of the Cowboys, of the Jones family, this a dozen times over the years. Those two guys have so much in common, Tex Schramm and Jerry Jones. And I think they are cut from the same cloth in many ways.
You know what?
And I think if Jerry Jones and Tex Schramm could sit together for 2 hours now, today's Jerry and then's Tex.
But I'll tell you this. I'll tell you this, Brad. This is very, very interesting that you're talking about this, because Tex Schramm wanted to make the World League of American Football. I think deep down, really deep down, he said, we're going to play spring football, and you know what? Eventually, we're going to have a big league, and we're going to compete with the big, bad NFL.
All of the things that he fought against from other
and
leagues.
That he loved.
But here's the thing they both have at their core. They love the Cowboys, do everything they can for the Cowboys. They were all about doing what was best for the NFL. That's why they're both in the Hall of Fame.
Here's the interesting thing. I will just say this as we close. I'm with Brad Schramm, the longtime voice of the Dallas Cowboys. Here's one of the reasons why I really respect Jerry Jones so much. So here we are at training camp, and I met with him yesterday, and we talked. And one of the things that he said to me was, you know, one of the great things about getting in the Hall of Fame, you know, you start to look at your career, and he said, and I realize I still really want to do this. I still really want to have an impact at my age. I want to do the kind of things that still that got me in here. And he said, I don't know exactly what they are, whether it's new media, franchises, stadiums, you know, teams in London or Mexico City, whatever. But he said, I want to grow this game and to make this game greater. And I said to myself, here's a guy who obviously can go build the mansion in the hill country or wherever, or in Arkansas or whatever, you know, and just basically say, man, I really did it, didn't I? Dad, you'd be proud of me. You know, but he wants to keep doing it.
Right, absolutely right. And he will keep doing it until he falls over.
Yeah.
They won't take it away from him. Someday his body will say, Jerry, enough! And that'll be that. But he is driven that way. And that's why he's done all the things he's done. His stadium changed stadiums. His practice facility is going to change practice facilities. He's going to keep doing it because that's who he is.
Brad Sham, I said it was going to be 20 minutes. It was 37. I hope you didn't mind. And I really, really appreciate you talking to me for the podcast.
Anytime, Peter. Anytime. You're my role model.
Oh, stop. Thank you.
Thanks to my guests, Bob McGinn and Brad Sham. If you enjoyed these conversations, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes in the MMQB series, like my conversations with Tom Brady, Adam Schefter, and Drew Brees. You can find these on the MMQB.com, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. You can also hear the MMQB podcast with Peter King on SiriusXM Radio every Saturday morning at 7 Eastern, on Mad Dog Sports Radio, SiriusXM, Channel 82. Thanks to the fine folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, and thanks, of course, to my sponsors, Harry's and State Farm. Please support them the way they support this podcast. And I'll see you next week.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.